Okay, thank you all for coming. This is a sobering topic that I'm going to be presenting, and there's a few pictures that are somewhat disturbing. I like to use photography in some of my lectures, so we'll try to keep this at least end on somewhat of an upbeat note with some suggestions for health professionals as to how to attack this major social injustice that occurs worldwide and has for centuries. So I want to give special thanks to Vic Seidel and Barry Levy. Some of this information that I'm presenting to you today came from their textbooks, War in Public Health and Terrorism in Public Health, and also photographers James Nakwe and Sebastio Salgado. So I'll begin by talking about the Sudanese genocide. I'll then talk about the history of wartime violence against women, particularly in the 20th century, notions of war and masculinity and how they're interrelated, the nature of violence and rape during war, the health consequences, what goes on in refugee camps, some of the major international human rights issues, the role of health professionals, and then make some recommendations. So in Darfur in the Sudan, the war that's been going on there for many years has taken anywhere between 180 and 460,000 lives, depending on how whose numbers you believe. Most of these are from disease. Well over a million individuals have been raped. This war has led to 5.5 million refugees and internally displaced persons, 2.7 of which are in refugee camps. What's going on is basically the government-supported Janjaweed Islamic militia is responsible for killing black Africans, and this war is fueled by arms sales to the Sudan from China, Russia, France, and a number of other countries. When he was in office, Bush the Lesser failed to call this situation a genocide, or did call the situation a genocide, but failed to act substantively. Part of the reason for this is that we were relying on the Sudan, which at one point harbored Osama bin Laden, for military intelligence. Similarly, the Obama administration has failed to do much about this situation. And a bipartisan Congressional Research Service report stated that the administration was concerned that holding Sudanese officials responsible for the genocide could, quote, disrupt cooperation, was their conclusion. Nevertheless, there were some mild economic sanctions put in place, as well as travel restrictions in May of 2007, and there is some hope that the creation of southern Sudan might bring peace. That remains to be seen, in part because South Sudan has a lot of oil, and Sudan in the north is the way to get that oil out. House attack. So, here we go. The other war that continues to go on to this day is what's known as Africa's World War in the so-called Democratic Republic of the Congo, where there have been anywhere between 700,000 and 3 million deaths, 2 million displaced persons, about 1.8 million women who've been raped, over 3 million who've been victims of intimate partner violence. And in 2011, the estimates were that 48 women were being raped per hour. This, of course, led to the unraveling of civil society, and the life expectancy for those born last year in the DRC is just 40 years. There have been 250 wars within the last century on the planet. Most of these conflicts are within and between small states. Many occur in sub-Saharan Africa, and the vast majority of casualties have been among civilians, which is an epidemiological flip from what we saw throughout the rest of recorded history up until the beginning of the 20th century. And some of the infamous genocides are the Chinese genocide under Mao, 30 million killed, the USSR genocide under Stalin primarily, 20 million, the Holocaust in Germany, about 11 to 12 million, and then the Japanese genocide in Manchuria and elsewhere, estimates are 10 million killed. And throughout history, women have been considered the spoils of war, going back to the abduction of Helen of Troy, the rape of this Sabine woman, and hundreds of thousands were raped in each of many individual conflicts during the 20th century, leading to untold millions over that century. This is a photo from James Nakwe from Serbia. Rape was widespread on both sides during World War II, although Americans were the least common perpetrators. Of course, we were the ones collecting the data, so it's hard to tell if that indeed was the case. But a particularly egregious example of the commodification of women's bodies was when the Japanese soldiers interred anywhere between 100,000 and 200,000 so-called comfort women into sexual slavery. These women came predominantly from Korea, but also from Burma, China, even Holland. Some of these women underwent forced hysterectomies to prevent menstruation and make them consistently available. More than half died in the camps due to mistreatment. And looking at an average 3 to 5 year detention with 5 to 20 rapes per day, a conservative estimate for 3 years of enslavement would be 7,500 rapes per woman. Japan to this day has not compensated any victims and has a large historical blindness to the atrocities committed. And if you go on my website, which I'll mention at the end, there's a slideshow on the history of human subject experimentation in the 20th century, which goes over the Nazi doctors' abuses as well as what happened in Japan with some of their experiments in chemical and biological weapons. In the Vietnam War, perpetrators included U.S. soldiers. Few of these were brought to justice. In the Bangladesh War for Independence in early 1970s, estimates go as high as 400,000 girls and women raped. This is probably an overly high estimate, but it's estimated that 25,000 pregnancies resulted from that. In 1994, during the Rwandan genocide, estimates are 250,000 women raped. In Bosnia in the 1990s, over 20,000 Muslim women raped. And there have been a number of other 20th century conflicts, predominantly civil wars, where rape has been widespread. In the 2000s, we saw sexual humiliation and rape of female detainees in Afghanistan and in Iraq. The poses that were photographed and sent through over the internet of sexual humiliation and forced homosexual poses from the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. And at Guantanamo Bay prison, Muslims were taunted with fake menstrual blood. Amnesty International, the Red Cross, and others have condemned the United States government for these practices. And these are the photos from Abu Ghraib. There's a link between notions of masculinity and warfare. There is, in our history books and our media, a pervasive glorification of war, and the acceptance of war as a means of conflict resolution. Much of this is linked to antiquated definitions of appropriate masculine behavior and coming-of-age rights. The vocabulary and the imagery of war are laden with denigrations of the feminine and perverse phallic imagery of weapons as extensions of male generative organs. So if you look at weapons ads or go to the trade shows, the weapons are described in terms of things like hardness and penetration and thrust. There's been a long-standing association of military bases with prostitution, which is tacitly accepted by the commanders. And men are the predominant decision makers in pursuing militarization, fighting wars, and resolving international conflicts. We also should remember that violence against women that occurs during war is on top of a background of societal or structural violence, which includes the legal, educational, political, and economic marginalization of women, as well as their impaired access throughout much of the world to reproductive health services. Rape in war tends to be more sadistic and violent than rape outside of war, and it's often committed in the presence of a woman's husband and children, who are often then killed. And often you will also get a situation where people are forced to commit sexual acts on family members. Another consequence of rape during war is pregnancy. During the Rwandan genocide, it's estimated there were about 5,000 pregnancies resulting from the rapes that took place, leading to the birth of the so-called children of bad blood. And it's not a surprise that the mothers of these children experience the usual traumas that go with rape, but also difficulty in caring for these children, which has led to a high rate of abandonment and infanticide. There are also male victims, men who are raped themselves, forced to commit rape against others, perform sex acts on prisoners or guards, castrated, undergo forced circumcisions or other sexual mutilations, and this is usually done under threat of death or torture. So the health consequences of rape are similar to the health consequences of rapes that occur in San Francisco and New York and Boston and elsewhere. These include traumatic injuries, including the development of fistulae, rectovaginal and vesicovaginal fistulae, STDs, including HIV, pregnancy, and these rapes occur in areas of the world where access to emergency contraception and abortion and even antibiotics is extremely limited. There are short-term psychological sequela and long-term sequela. The long-term, you can imagine PTSD, multiple somatic symptoms, flashbacks, and ultimately persistent fears and the blunted enjoyment of life and the inability to experience the full richness of having a romantic relationship. Unfortunately, women also have to deal with peacekeepers who have become violent. There is currently an investigation ongoing into the 7,000-man African Union peacekeeping force for raping and abusing local women in 2010, where refugees were forced to inter-rape at border crossings as the price of passage. Guards might rape women or force them into sex in return for this passage, for protection from bandits in exchange for things like food. And the presence of abusive guards inside the camps with bandits just outside the camps makes simple tasks such as just going to the latrine or gathering water or firewood dangerous and even life-threatening. There are quite naturally many human rights issues involved here. Violence against women and girls violates several principles enshrined in international and regional human rights law, including the right to life, equality, security, equal protection under the law, and freedom from torture and other cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment. Rape was first prosecuted, at least rape and warfare, during the Tokyo War Crimes Trial. In 1993, the UN Commission on Human Rights passed a resolution calling rape a crime of war. In 2001, the International War Crimes Tribunal ruled that rape in war is a crime against humanity, and there have been a few successful prosecutions of rape as a war crime and as an act of genocide over the last 20 years. In 2009, and then continuing on to the present, the International Criminal Court, to which the U.S. is not a signatory, has issued a warrant for the arrest of Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir for human rights abuses, genocide, and basically leading the genocidal rapes that are going on in the Sudan. Unfortunately, he remains in power today. There are also some international agreements that relate to rape and war. CEDAW, the Convention of the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, was adopted by the UN General Assembly in 1979, and it calls for equality of the sexes in political, social, cultural, civil, and other fields. It's been ratified by 162 different countries, but not the United States. There's UN Security Council Resolution 1325, which was adopted in 2000 and mandates the protection of and respect for the human rights of women and girls and calls on all parties to armed conflict to take specific measures to protect women and girls from gender-based violence, particularly rape and sexual violence. Again, the U.S. has not signed on to this resolution. There also is an International Criminal Court, which was established by International Treaty in 2002, which codifies accountability for gender-based crimes against women during military conflict by defining sexual and gender violence of all crimes, of all kinds, as war crimes. Again, similar pattern here, 139 countries have signed on, the U.S. has not. And this is true in multiple international treaties, whether it's the Stockton Treaty on Persistent Organic Pollutants, whether it's the Convention on the Suppression of Traffic in Persons, which basically is to prevent child sexual slavery and international sex trafficking, other environmental treaties, the Basel Convention on Transboundary Passage of Toxic Waste. The U.S. tends not to sign on to these international treaties. So what can health professionals do? The first is to conduct a full history and physical exam to treat physical injuries and STDs, to offer emergency contraception and abortion services, and to provide counseling and ongoing psychological support. We have an obligation to facilitate reporting to the appropriate authorities and gather forensic evidence. And provide documentation of our findings in triplicate with a copy for the victim, a copy for the UN High Commission on Refugees, and for the provider's medical agency. These health exams should be conducted in a confidential manner by trained workers in a safe environment, and obviously female providers should be widely available. In refugee camps, water collection points and latrines should be placed in central, well-lighted areas, and food should be distributed directly to the women themselves. there should be housing of female-headed groups and unaccompanied children in safe areas in the centers of the camp, and women should be involved in the design and the running of the camps. So in conclusion, each war that takes place represents a failure of our species to live in harmony, a waste of precious human capital, and a further scourge on an environment that's already suffering from the effects of global warming and other pollutants. And rape represents the malevolent nature of human behavior and is a crime against not only women, but against all of humanity. Given the increasing spread of technology and materials for the construction of weapons of both small and large-scale destruction, the enormity of the social and environmental problems facing humanity and the realistic potential for the demise of the human species, rapid change is desperately needed. The U.S. must play a leadership role in limiting consumption, in cutting unnecessary military programs, and increasing funds and using troops for international peacemaking instead of for making war. And we need to build our alliances with the UN and other international agencies to resolve international disputes. We must vigorously investigate our own human rights abuses and fully prosecute those responsible and sign on to these international agreements. I would hope that during the next Congress, depending on what happens during the election, that the International Violence Against Women Act will be resurrected. This act would require the U.S. government to prevent and respond to violence against women and girls as a specific part of U.S. foreign policy and AIDS programs. And we should join again with the international community to apply both economic as well as military pressure, including the protective use of military troops to halt genocide and mass rape when they do occur. So just as we failed to halt the genocide in the Sudan and failed to act in Rwanda, yet we continue to say, never again. And it's time for our nation to have its policies match its rhetoric. So there are a number of references. They're all available on my website. This presentation, in fact, a much longer version of this presentation, is available on the website. It's publichealthandsocialjustice.org or phsj.org. There are probably about 150 open access PowerPoints on there, and there's a whole page devoted to war and another page devoted to women's health where you'll find PowerPoints on things like access to emergency contraception and abortion, weapons of mass destruction, that sort of thing. I'm also going to, at my editor's request, and hawk my book when there's some people like poor Josh and Marge have seen me do this in multiple venues. I'm sorry to have to do this again, but there's flyers back there and a sample copy, and there's a chapter. Thank you. There's a chapter on women and another chapter on war in the book with essays from other APHA luminaries that I'm sure you'll recognize. So I think my time just ended, and thank you all.